Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel today is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dauphineau. The court has one matter before it this afternoon. I understand all the lawyers are ready, so if you call the first case.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Brister, along with Kendall Gray and Shelby Sharp here. I represent the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth and the Corporation of the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth. The odd thing about this case is when my colleague and counterpart, Frank Gilstrap, stands up, he'll say the same thing. We brought this Rule 12 motion because both of us can't represent the same party. Clearly, we both represent different groups. So one of us must be wrong, and the courts need to decide that. They need to decide that now. In my presentation, subject to the court's pleasure, I want to make 3 points. The first one about the Rule 12 motion, that the trial court abused its discretion and that appeal would not be an adequate remedy. Second, in response to the plaintiff's response, that whether this court should follow compulsory deference or neutral principles to argue that this point out that this court has already decided that question and has adopted neutral principles. And third, to try to give the court some assistance, if I can, in trying to reconcile some of the church-state cases and property disputes that's sometimes a little hard to put all together. I will argue that they're governed by two principles, both from the First Amendment, consent from the Free Exercise Clause, and avoiding doctrinal questions from the Establishment Clause, and that the parties here consented that a Texas corporation would hold title, that it could set up its own articles and bylaws however it wanted, that it did so, and it never consented that the administrative office of the Episcopal Church could fire all those trustees, could replace them all, and or could hire attorneys for them on their behalf. And on the doctrinal question, I'll be arguing that this is not a doctrinal question, it's a legal question. While in many circumstances these issues could be doctrinal questions, and these, the corporate documents, make them one where the court doesn't need to decide any doctrine to decide who has the authority to hire these attorneys. First, on Rule 12, this court has stated, and this court, interestingly, has written more about Rule 12, I think, than any other court in the state. And in Mobile Homes of America, cited in both parties' brief, this court said specifically what Rule 12 was for in 1975. Use of a Rule 12 motion, I'm quoting from the court's opinion, it seems to us presupposes acceptance of the fact that there's an identifiable person, who could be represented by a party, but that the attorneys representing themselves as agents to file and prosecute the suit, in fact, had not been employed by to do so. So there's an entity or person, and they weren't, the attorney who says they represent them wasn't hired by them to do so. Now, in that particular case, Rule 12 was held not applicable. It was a case where the question was the corporation had law forfeited its charter for not paying taxes, and so they were disputing about that. But there was no question there was a corporation, and there was no question it had hired those attorneys. It was just that the dispute wasn't about that, so that wasn't a Rule 12 case. This case, of course, that is, there is a diocese. Everybody agrees on that. There is a corporation. The question is whether it hired the two plaintiff's attorneys. As we said, and that's what we raised in our Rule 12 motion. We said that no one in authority with the diocese or diocesan corporation hired or retained Mr. Nelson and Ms. Wells to prosecute this suit on behalf of the diocese and the corporation, and whoever did hire them or retain them holds no position of authority in either entity. So this is a classic Rule 12 case. Now, question, can that be addressed by mandamus, or shouldn't we take that up at the end of the trial or allow the trial court to defer it? First, of course, the trial court didn't defer a ruling. The trial court ruled on it, so that's not an issue. We've gone over in our briefs, and I won't repeat all the things in our briefs about why we think mandamus is appropriate. Confusion, as you've seen in the record, They submitted new articles of incorporation for the corporation. We submitted new articles and took them back. So the Secretary of State's getting articles of incorporation from both sides. The mail is being delivered to the wrong place. My favorite one I found this morning, if you put in Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth in Google, you get two websites. Now, I'm happy to say, if you punch "I'm feeling lucky," you get our website. But there are two websites. They take different positions on all these issues. Second, the Republican Party versus Dietz. You've got First Amendment issues here. A lot of people, a lot of property involved. You wouldn't probably want to take mandamus on every Rule 12 motion. But this case is different, and that's what the Prudential and AIU, that's what the mandamus is. You weigh the costs and benefits in the particular case, and those are important in these cases.
Well, aren't you really asking us to determine which party had authority to hire the attorneys, and in effect asking which party has the authority to be the party?
Right.
So doesn't that get beyond the Rule 12 issue into the merits?
No, who has authority to file suit? We're not asking you to decide who has authority over the property. That's back down in court and issues to be resolved on that. But the right way to file this suit, it's not that hard. Brown versus Clark. That's the very first, one of the earliest Texas, probably the only Texas Supreme Court case on property disputes in a church. And the first line of Brown versus Clark, which is 116 Southwest 360, Texas Supreme Court, 1909, says that this suit was instituted in the district court by William Clark, W.F. Jones, et cetera, several named people, claiming that they constituted the church session of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church against G.W. Brown, W.S. Haywood, other people, who claimed to be the church session of the Presbyterian Church. The object of the suit was to recover from the defendants the property deeded to the church. So the individuals, we don't have any objection to whoever their person asserting bishop is, whoever they assert to be the trustees, suing in their own name. We've not objected, haven't filed a Rule 12 motion as to that. That's the way you file this suit. What causes confusion is if you file it Exxon Corporation versus Exxon Corporation. Because, of course, what's the judgment going to say? I mean, if this court says, for instance, we render judgment in favor of the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth, well, who won? If you assess costs against the corporation for the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth, we don't know who's supposed to pay costs. You can't enter in judgment without deciding who the parties are. And we've quoted the U.S. Interstate Commerce Commission from the U.S. Supreme Court. The courts, because of subject matter jurisdiction, have to look behind the names that symbolize the parties to determine whether a justiciable case or controversy is present. The trial court, of course, recognized this. The trial court's order says, I'm finding the plaintiff's attorneys don't have authority to represent the corporation and a diocese associated with Bishop Eicher. But we describe parties by name. We don't describe them by who they're associated with, because, of course, who's associated with who can change. And so the judgments and court orders have to be by names. That's why you have to get the right name. That's why we have all the thing about getting the right names of parties, because the judgments have to be enforceable by name. We have to know who to enforce them against.
That reminds me a little bit of a subrogation suit where an insurance company has to reveal at some point that it represents, that it's suing in the shoes of the insured, but what it has to reveal what its real name is. Is there an analogy there?
Well, yes. I think that was the, which case was that? Like the Sloan versus Rivers from this court, where somebody was an assignee. Can you sue in your assignee's name alone? Yes. Do you have to change that before the judgment? No, you don't. But you do if the other side files a Rule 12 motion. You have to prove why you can sue in their name, and that's what they didn't do in that case. So now insurance cases, of course, because the insurance is on the line contractually, they never try to ditch it by saying, oh, well, that's not us, unless, of course, there's some a deck action separately disputing them. The question on neutral principles versus deference. The plaintiffs have taken the position that no Texas court, I think they say, has used neutral principles to decide a church property dispute. And I think that may be right because most Texas church property disputes preceded Jones versus Wolfe, the U.S. Supreme Court case in 1979 that said neutral principles is a constitutional principle that courts can adopt. This court, of course, did adopt neutral principles in Dean versus Alford in 1999, an opinion by now Chief Justice Livingston. This court said courts do have jurisdiction to review matters involving civil contract or property rights, even though they stem from a church controversy. Neutral principles of law must be applied to decide such matters so that courts do not violate the constitutional prohibition against government-established religion. Now, having adopted that, and that was, I forget the dispute in that, but it was, I think it was about who could preach on Sunday morning. But it would be very odd for this court to say, well, we've adopted neutral principles in everything, but not in property cases. Neutral principles was developed for a property case. It was developed in a property case. I think Texas, it would be unprecedented for Texas law to be, we're going to use neutral principles in everything else, but not in property cases. That's what it was developed and designed for.
Well, in that case, in the Jones case, the Georgia Supreme Court had already ruled based on neutral principles, hadn't it, by the time the Supreme Court ruled, and
yes.
it was approving the use of the majority rule as a neutral principle. Is that right?
Well, I think the first time it appeared, the word neutral principles appears is 10 years before in the Blue Hull Church case. But that's, there had been some question about what it meant and whether a majority agreed with it or not. And I think it is correct to say that it was not officially approved by the Supreme Court as constitutional. They say we hold that a court can do neutral principles. So courts had been, some courts in some states had been involved deciding cases by neutral principles. It was one of the interesting things in researching this case. It was news to me. A lot of states have statutes on this. Virginia and California, they have statutes that say if there's a dispute between a national church and a local church, the local church wins, or the national church wins. I'm frankly shocked. They have one in New York, which is decided for a specific church. The Russian Orthodox Church is going to be, bishop is going to be this guy and not that guy. That's what the state legislature said. Now, we haven't done that in Texas, so different courts had different rules for how you decide these disputes. A lot of them passed by the legislature. But it wasn't neutral principles as far as a constitutional approach wasn't adopted or approved constitutionally until Jones versus Wolfe.
I'd like you to go back to something you said before. You said that deciding this case won't decide the property issues because they're separate and apart. And you said that we should apply neutral principles because that's what you're supposed to apply in a property case. This really is to determine eventually the disposition of this will determine who gets the property.
No. They can do the same thing that happened in Brown versus Clark. That's why I cited. They can file their bishop, their trustees can file suit in their own names saying the court should remove our bishop or our trustees and place them in charge of the corporation's assets. They can do that. For the reasons we say in our brief, we've given you a handout with the corporation's bylaws and rules, and we think the reason they don't want to do that is because they know they'll lose on that one. But that's not the issue. They can still do that, and they'll either win or lose on corporate law. What they're asking for here is exception for corporation law. There's no question in Texas corporation law. The president, the trustees, the members, the directors are who the articles of incorporation say they are. And if those articles of incorporation or bylaws amended and filed, then that's how we're going to decide those things. What they're saying is we want an exception for churches. Corporate law is not going to apply to us because we're going to replace the corporate officers whenever we want, and we get our way. In fact, it's interesting. The only difference, I think, between the neutral principles, the only place neutral principles and compulsory deference makes a difference is when a church wants to renege on its promises. If a church wants to keep its promises and it's made a promise, it's got an ecclesiastical authority that wants to keep the promise, the two approaches come out the same way. The only time they come out different is when the church has made a promise and it wants to renege on it. Because neutral principles will say, you made a promise, you stick with it. Deference does say, whatever promises they made, you join the church knowing the Pope could change them. And so they can do whatever they want. We think that would be a bad law in Texas to say that we're going to follow the compulsory deference approach where whatever the parties said can be reneged on by the ecclesiastical authority. See, my time's up, so be seated.
Any other questions? No? All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, the question before this court is whether the trial judge abused his discretion in failing to grant Rule 12 relief. Now, the trial judge reasoned this way. He said, to decide who has authority to hire attorneys, I've got to decide who has authority to control the diocese and the corporation. We say that is, who is a bishop and who are the trustees. Same question. And I'm choosing, since that involves the merits, I'm choosing to carry that to trial. The question is, does the trial judge have that power? Rule 12 appears to give it to him. It has permissive language. It says that the motion may be heard and determined any time before the parties have announced. Doesn't have to be. It can be carried or decided preliminarily and carried and finally decided on the merits, which is what the judge wanted to do here. Moreover, no Texas court on appeal or mandamus has ever reversed the denial of a Rule 12 motion. That distinguishes our cases from all the cases that both sides cited where they were reviewing a grant of a Rule 12 motion. Obviously, the trial court's discretion in that regard to deny and carry should be broader. And I want you to think about the practical consequences if you rule for them in this case. Our case is a typical church property dispute. One group has left the local church, or in this case, the local diocese, and taken the property with them. The group loyal to the hierarchical church has brought suit in the name of the church, or in this case, the name of the diocese. That is how every church property dispute begins. If you rule for them, then the defendant in these cases can simply file a Rule 12 motion and say, let's decide this on Rule 12, citing N. Ray Salazar. Now, they think that's a great idea. We don't have to trifle with such niceties as marshaling evidence, objecting to evidence, summary judgment. Indeed, we don't even need a trial judge. We can decide it on mandamus. But that is precisely the wrong way to decide these cases, and we need to look no further than authority from the U.S. Supreme Court. Every church property case involves a delicate balancing of First Amendment issues. How far can the secular authority reach into this controversy to decide it? Sensitive First Amendment question, and the Supreme Court has said that when you have a constitutional question, you must decide it on an adequate and full-bodied record. Well, our record probably doesn't meet that. Our record is fairly voluminous. They have nothing on file, but no one has objected our evidence. We haven't gone through the normal testing process of trial. This case is not ready for decision under the First Amendment. Moreover, in church property cases, the granddaddy of all cases is Watson against Jones, in which the court said, these issues must be decided on the merits and cannot be decided as a preliminary question. That's exactly what they're asking you to do. And there's one other point that I really didn't think of till Justice Dolfino asked her question, and that is this. Ultimately, we boil down to deciding ecclesiastical questions. These cannot be decided in a vacuum. They can only be decided in connection with a property or contract dispute. When that's on the table, the court then can award the contractor, enforce the contractor, award the property. But when it's in a vacuum, I seriously doubt if, for example, we could file suit to say that Bishop Eicher is or is not the Bishop of Fort Worth. That's an ecclesiastical question. The courts can't decide that in a vacuum. Well, in this Rule 12 proceeding, they've succeeded in separating the ecclesiastical question from the property question. Property's not on the table in this court. And I think you should have serious doubts as to whether or not you can even decide this case in that posture. And under those circumstances, of course, you would have to deny mandamus relief.
Well, counsel, would we deny or would we dismiss? Because we have no jurisdiction to decide that question.
Well, I think you would have to deny. You have jurisdiction. You have jurisdiction to decide the mandamus issue. You can decide that it involves an ecclesiastical question and therefore it can't be decided. But you cannot, I don't believe, simply say that, you know, simply dismiss the case. That would be my position on it. With that said,
Mr. Gill,
yes.
If the court were to rule that this is an ecclesiastical matter and that we have no jurisdiction, wouldn't that mean that your clients win?
I think it might. And candidly, Justice Meyer, I haven't really followed that train of thought out. But if it dismisses the case, then the Rule 12 motion or order stays in place. The court decided nothing. So either way, I think we win.
Is it your client's position and your position before the court that your clients in their own names, not in the name of the diocese or the corporation,
yes,
are precluded from presenting issues in the trial court that would determine the property questions?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
Can the property questions be decided if the parties who are the named parties that your clients that you represent and that Mr. Nelson as well represent were named as individuals as opposed to are individuals in a capacity of whatever they want to claim, as opposed to there not being a proper issue before the trial court on property if we decided to grant this mandate?
If you decide to grant the mandamus, the question is, what do we have left?
Yes.
And candidly, I'm not going to, I can't say what position we would take if that occurred, because it hasn't happened yet. I do say this, I will concede, that if you decide those questions, you will touch on the underlying issues in the case. Who is the bishop and who are the trustees? You will have to touch on, you have to consider those issues if you decide this mandamus proceeding against us. Because the only way that you can rule against us is to, first of all, is to say that, well, the trial judge abused his discretion and he made the wrong ruling. And that gets to the merits question, which I do want to spend a little bit of time on if I can. With regard to the merits, that is, we say that first of all, we have to decide whether or not the court applies neutral principles or the deference rule. Counsel is correct. No Texas court has ever done what he's asking you to do, and that is this: to apply neutral principles in order to say that the hierarchical church, the people aren't loyal to the hierarchical church, cannot get the property. Sometimes they purport to apply neutral principles and say, well, this is an ecclesiastical question and we have to defer to the national church. Same result. That's what the court did in Dean, I believe, in a contract case. But no court has ever gone there. And if the Texas, and under Wolf, Texas can choose to do that. But as an intermediate court, I respectfully suggest that's not your role. That call has got to be made with the Texas Supreme Court. Now, let's suppose that you decide, well, we are going to apply neutral principles. Well, the elephant in the room on neutral principles is ecclesiastical question. The rule, as stated by the court in Wolf, even under a neutral principles approach, when church documents incorporate religious concepts, the court must still defer to the resolution of the doctrinal issues by the authoritative ecclesiastical body. The courts have said that these type of ecclesiastical questions include questions of discipline and government. Question of discipline: who is the bishop in this case? That is an ecclesiastical question to which the court must defer to the Episcopal Church. You simply cannot read the Serbian Orthodox case. I believe it's Milivojevic. And you cannot read that without making the clear conclusion that ecclesiastical, that who is the bishop, who are the members of the hierarchy, is a core matter of ecclesiastical concern. You cannot get more ecclesiastical than who is the bishop. So you have to defer to the National Church on the question of who is the bishop. The trustees is a little bit different. I would concede in some cases maybe that could not be an ecclesiastical question. But the courts have said where church documents incorporate religious concepts, it's an ecclesiastical question. And in this case, to be a trustee, they have to be lay clergy or lay persons in good standing. That is an ecclesiastical question. We've got the Grineas case out of Houston. And there, the church document said that the trustees had to uphold the discipline and regulations of the Greek Orthodox Church. That was an ecclesiastical question. In Cherry Valley, the trustees had to be selected according to the custom and practices of the church. That was an ecclesiastical question. Who is a member of the church is an ecclesiastical question. Tran against Fiorenza, the case out of Houston, the court held that the excommunication of a priest was an ecclesiastical question. So when you get down to the bottom line, if you get there, which we say you shouldn't, you decide who is the bishop. You have to defer to the church. Bishop Gulick was the bishop, not Bishop Eichert. You have to defer to the church on the question of who are the trustees. The old trustees left the church. Bishop Gulick appointed new trustees. The old trustees were no longer members in good standing, according to Bishop Gulick. He gets to decide, not the courts. So at the end of the day, the Episcopal Church says who is the bishop, the Episcopal Church says who is the trustee. That decides who gets the property. There's no doubt. There's one diocese, there's one corporation. The question is who controls it. It also decides the Rule 12 issue in our favor. But you don't have to go there. And finally, let me just say this. Of course, this is a while this is an ordinary church dispute, it's also a high-profile church. And it's easy for people to get carried away about the underlying issues. They're hard-fought. Everybody has an opinion on those things. And those can affect churches. The Illinois Supreme Court, for example, Bishop Dionysius in that case, he had built the Serbian Orthodox Church in the United States. He was the face of the church for 30 years. And that may not be important here, but believe me, it was important in Chicago. And there, some people from Yugoslavia had come in and removed him from office, reorganized the diocese, and eventually defrocked him, probably not in accordance with their church rules, their church documents. The Supreme Court said the secular courts cannot go there. The controlling issue, the controlling principle, the pole star in this case, is the First Amendment. And with regard to that, we've got to remember that it's a precious right for churches to be able to govern themselves free of the interference of the courts. The First Amendment gives religious bodies the right to decide for themselves, free from state interference, matters of court governance. That's exactly what we have here. That's what the court said in Miljevojevic. All the courts can ultimately do is to accept the decision of the church and then use its secular power to award the property. But again, that is a long way away. This court can decide this on the question of the trial court's discretion, and please think very, very long and hard before you take this power to carry issues to trial away from trial judges.
Mr. Gilstrap, yes. Your clients initiated this litigation and are calling on the courts to make a ruling under the Declaratory Judgment Act. And isn't your argument dead against that kind of action?
No.
Because the decision is an ecclesiastical decision, and therefore the court shouldn't get involved.
The court should not get involved in the ecclesiastical decision, which is who is the bishop, who are the trustees, therefore who controls the corporation and the diocese.
But then that determines the property issue.
Of course it does. And that is a and at that point then the court should first defer and say these issues have been decided, and then it should do the one thing, the only thing that it can do in this case other than defer, and that is to say, therefore, the property belongs to the loyalist group. That's all the courts can do, and that is where the secular power comes in, because the church cannot enforce its own decision.
Thank you for answering my question.
Yes, I have a question, too. Along that line, in the pleadings for declaratory judgment that you filed, or the plaintiffs have filed, part of the relief requested is to have the use of the name and seal of what? Of the diocese?
Of the diocese. The diocese has a name and a seal. And we say that's property.
You say that's property.
Yes.
That doesn't have anything to do with your bringing the suit in the name of the diocese.
No, it simply has, you know, both sides obviously can sue in the name of the diocese. The courts can't stop them, and they shouldn't stop them. At the end of the day, the only question is, which side, who is the bishop, and who are the trustees? And that decides the case.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Scott, is it rebuttal? It's your rebuttal.
Let me just make two corrections to what my colleague said. First, note that no church has ever decided these identity issues. Well, the Supreme Court did in Jones versus Wolfe. They specifically said states can adopt a rule that the majority of the church wins because the majority faction generally can be identified without resolving any question of religious doctrine or polity. So, if the question is, the bishop is defined as who's the best preacher in the diocese, the court's not going to be able to decide that. If it says who was chosen by the majority at the convention, courts can decide that. You can count the votes. If it's who was faithful to the doctrine of the church, courts can't decide that. That's a doctrinal question. If it's who was the person recognized by the majority of the board of trustees of the corporation, which is how the articles of the corporation define the bishop, of course courts can look and see who the majority of the trustees voted for. Second, he says, and it's easy to fall over into this mistake, saying we need to defer to the national church. Compulsory deference doesn't say you defer to the national church. In a congregational church, you don't defer to the national church. And in the Episcopal church, as we argue, it's a mess. It's all mixed up. Episcopal means bishop. This is what the Great Schism was about 1,000 years ago, that the Bishop of Rome decided he was preeminent, and the Orthodox churches said, no, he's not. So this depends upon the particular church whether a national office is preeminent. On the Book of Common Prayer, the Episcopal Constitution makes the General Convention preeminent. Yes, it's hierarchical on what the Book of Common Prayer says. On calling a diocesan convention, it is not hierarchical. Only the bishop or the local standing committee can call a special committee, and that's what their case turns on, because there was no bishop here. Bishop has to be appointed locally. Their only argument has happened at a special convention. And that cannot be called by an outside bishop because outside bishops can't do anything new in an existing diocese. An outside bishop can be sent into only places where there is no organized diocese. That's, of course, what they did. They started a new diocese, which is fine, and we can fight later about who gets the name, but they can't hire one for the existing. They filed this suit as the diocese that was formed in 1983, and that's not them. The trial court didn't defer. As I mentioned earlier, the trial court ruled on the Rule 12 motion. The record, we could have a big, long trial on this, and we could do as they propose you do, which is hire experts. Believe me, we can hire an expert to come in and say, no, it's not hierarchical. But who hires the attorneys is an easy matter of corporate law. If this was a corporation, we wouldn't be having this dispute because you look at corporate law and the board governs. This is a Texas corporation. Unless this court's going to make an exception for churches, which it would have to do if it's a doctrinal question, but counting up votes at a board meeting is not a doctrinal question. I'll conclude with this. I've been involved in a number of splits and church splits in my career, several as a judge, three, unfortunately, as a church member. The most striking thing I've seen and heard about this one is that it appears the personal animosity on each side appears to have been relatively low. Many on each side remain friends, and in a few cases, they even share the same buildings here in Fort Worth. I think this dispute might have worked itself out, given time, but then the administrative office of the Episcopal Church filed this suit saying, we want it all. In doing that, they overreached. In several respects, we say the main one at issue today, they overreached by appointing attorneys, hiring attorneys for a corporation and an association in which they've never served, which they've never appointed or replaced officers before, without any authority in their own documents or in the authority of those documents to do so, without any basis in Texas law allowing them to do so, all by justified by the claim we're the national church and we get to say. I don't think that's either what the First Amendment requires or allows or what Texas law does. We ask the court to find the plaintiff's attorney have not shown authority to file suit in the names of the corporation and diocese and to order the trial court to dismiss them as party plaintiffs and pursue the rest of the case in whatever form they wish to. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted. And there's nothing else for us today, so this court will be adjourned.
All rise.